Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Shankleberg and Adam Barrett, are you online today?
I'm right here. How's it going?
Good. We just turned off the cameras. I had a moment there going, who was I talking to?
Oh, boy. Is that coffee cup? You want to take a moment and fill it up?
Yeah, I'm going to have to. We're doing this recording, trying to fit it into our schedule, so it's a bit early here on the West Coast. But all the better so that we can catch, you know, our thoughts unfiltered to some extent. That might be what happens. So, Adam, recently, I think it was last week, was in the news, the autonomous car from Tesla had a fatal accident. And the part of the headline was that it was implicating the autonomous driving feature of the car. Did you hear about that?
Yeah, I did. It was interesting. You know, some of the headlines were interesting. You know, like it's an automotive milestone that everybody was kind of anticipating. When was the first, you know, fatality for autonomous driving? You know, and it's occurred. So now we can all, you know, analyze it and understand and decide, you know, how does this affect how it gets integrated? And
Well, I saw headlines of, you know, that. Will it ever be good enough? Is artificial intelligence the doom of mankind? I saw a bunch of panic type headlines of in and around this technology. And one of the aspects, and I wrote about this in a paper that I presented at RAMS last year, was, well, how good does it need to be from a reliability point of view? And in the paper I wrote about delivery drones, assuming you were a reliability engineer with, say, Amazon, and they were working on this package delivery system. And I've heard people say they would never want a package delivery drone to come by. It's dangerous. It's going to fall out of the sky. Those things are big. They crush you. Right. Those whirling blades will slice you to pieces. It has no brain. Blah, 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 blah.
Right. As opposed to the 30-year-old truck barreling down your street that your kids are playing on, driven by a stranger. Right? Like, that's what I want. I want that instead.
That's right. Yeah, I want this, you know.
The guy's tired. He's been driving for 8 hours. He's exhausted. He's looking at a list and a map and not paying attention. And your kids, yeah, like it's so funny that the things. It's a matter of comfort, right? In so many cases, and yeah, and with each new technology, there's, you know, you have the fear of it. And I remember my father telling me that his great grandmother used to cover up the outlets on the walls because she was worried the electricity would be wasted just coming out of the outlet. Mm-hmm. Because in her mind, she was equating it to water or something, and that you just couldn't see it, you know. So it just and
well, it's yeah, a utility, just, and it's, you know, right. It's always there, and
right, yeah. Right. She thought you'd save electricity by covering it up. And one of my other ones with this Tesla thing that is the battery and fire, right? So with mm-hmm. the lithium-ion battery, if you recall, not too long ago, they had a puncture. You know, it was like last year, something, you know, somebody dropped like a trailer hitch off the back of a truck, which was huge. So it hit the battery pack. The car told the driver to pull over. The driver got out, and about 10 minutes later, the battery caught fire. And people are like, electric cars are dangerous. I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm like, if that was a gas tank, it would have ruptured right there. It caught that car on fire, caught the car behind it on fire, spread 10 gallons of gas on the highway. Like, and that's verbal. You know, it's fascinating. Like, would you, if you were barbecuing, would you rather barbecue over a battery pack or a can of gasoline? You know, like,
yeah. No, you know. Well, there's what I'm thinking of is back to the when automobiles first hit the roads. And you mentioned the fear aspect of it is that it was not dependable though. It just, you had to carry a mechanic basically with you in the first cars that were on and what were so-called roads. And you had to carry all kinds of repair kits and patch kits and airplanes. The first aircraft were they crashed more often than they landed. But cars are competing with existing technology that's that looks and feels exactly the same. But why is that fear still there?
It's new. Anything new. Anything new. If I tell you, if I paint something blue and you're used to seeing it red, it's new. And what is it, what happens when it's blue? And I don't, I'm not used to blue. And you know, mm-hmm. like it's human nature, I think.
Well, Google kind of went through and has been very, very cautious. They've been driving their little kind of almost look like toy cars in Nevada for years and in other places just on test tracks and test runs and just trying to see, just to accumulate miles on them. And one, to learn from an engineering point of view, but they're not on a track to launch vehicles. Now, I'm sure they're selling parts of the technology and they're selling, you know, the concept and so on. And I, from what I understand, they're in the process of developing cars. But they're in the news about making it work. And I think from a reliability engineering point of view is you're in the spotlight. Like these poor folks over at Tesla that were part of the programming for the autonomous driving feature. And if any one piece of that failed from a reliability point of view and from a customer's point of view, a failure is a reliability problem. It's not dependable. It's not trustworthy, and more of that generic concept. Well, how good do you need to be? You know, how do you set a reliability goal that you're making a brand new technology that fits into an existing vehicle? So you're competing with existing vehicles. If I'm going to charge $50,000 for this car, it should last as long as a standard issue GM vehicle at $50,000. Right? It should be not as often in maintenance. It should be as good as or better than. But it's new. We don't know.
Yep.
So how do you set it for the societal fear? I guess that's the question.
Right. That's the problem. We're not talking about statistics or math or actually doing a design of experiments. We're talking about emotions, and it's almost, how do you give a hug with this new product? Because it's totally irrational, right? So that's a thing. And when we were talking about this earlier, deciding on, you know, with the episode, what we'd like to talk about today, you brought up the nuclear, you know, power program, and that, you know, I don't think we've made a new nuclear power plant since the 70s, just out of fear.
Well, it's not been publicized if it has been done.
Yeah. And the sad thing is that we've killed far more people with coal and other, you know, things, you know, but it's on a different scale, right? It's what's familiar, what's not. People burn wood in their fireplace at home, and that's fine. And, you know, nuclear, everybody knows nuclear can be used to make bombs, right? So how do you sell that? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's emotional, and it makes sense from an emotional standpoint. If you think of where the origins come from, is that if you have a dog and you pet your dog, oh, what a great dog. And so you see a tiger in the woods and you've never seen a tiger before, and it kind of looks like a dog, but is it? I'm going to play it safe, you know, until I learn about it. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. Just because it turns out it's a good chance it can kill you. So it's I think that unfortunately what it comes down to is time. I think that it's unfortunately a matter of time to where it goes from people telling you an electric car is safe to you see them, your neighbor has one, you know, and that they're okay. And
So
the thing is, how can you as somebody with that technology advance that and associate your brand to it as fast as possible? And it's very tricky. A lot of people have had a hard time with it. I mean, speaking of automotive advancements, I mean, like Tucker, you remember the Tucker? They made a movie out of it too. He was way ahead of his time. This is in the 1950s. He developed a car that had amazing features and all kinds of things. And that was actually part of the downfall because like he wanted to put seatbelts in, but it was argued against it because that would make people think the car crashed. So they didn't put seatbelts in, you know, and that's the way it went back then. Seatbelts would not sell cars because then it implied that the car crashed and people didn't want to think about cars crashing. So it's almost like it's his time, right?
Well, on the other end of the spectrum is airbags with the Takata airbag inflator problem. People, they can't even replace them fast enough. There's plenty of cars out there with these allegedly bad inflators.
Right.
But we're not all running to the shop to get them disabled. We'd rather have the airbag than the chance that it would kill us.
Yep. So as a reliability team, what do you do? How do you do this? You know, it's, you know, because the way it comes down to us and whatever I've experienced, people say, okay, what should our reliability goal be at release? Right.
Yeah. Two.
And how do you determine the goal? Right. And so now we're talking about tying it to something emotional almost, right? If you're trying to back it out from an emotional
it's not really unprecedented, though. I mean, even if it's not a brand new technology, is that our marketing and our branding and our customer satisfaction for many products is based on product reliability. Mm-hmm. Think of the HP test and measurement systems or the laser printers or calculators. Those were just so rock solid and so much more durable than the competitors that they were able to have a price premium based on the word of mouth sense that they would just last forever.
So let's back that out, though. If you were on that program and you were the reliability engineer and they said, that's our goal is to make it to be so rock solid reliable, we can charge a premium, that's the market we're going for. How would you decide what target that they have to develop to? Because they also have a time to market. They can't develop it for 10 years to make it 99.99999.
Right.
How would you interpret that?
Well, that's actually had that question from the laptop division, is they wanted to stand out from the competitors in the laptop field. And this was almost 20 years ago, that they were the most reliable one is built on the HP brand. And at that point, they were designed and built by the same group in Taiwan as all the other laptops on the market at the time. So they were just run-of-the-mill in the middle. And the gap between the perception of what the HP brand was supposed to do and their performance was killing them. It was, even though the reliability-wise, they were just as good as anybody else, the perception was they should be better. And so what we did is we looked at what the existing problems were and how reliable they were at the existing point and said, your target is twice that. We don't know how good it has to be before the customers notice, but it has to be markedly good. So let's make it as reliable as absolutely possible. That's the number one priority in the design and assembly process, is to make it as reliable as possible. And what implied, though, is that with the general manager and his staff, was that they had to basically double their investment in the development of this, use the best materials, components, assembly processes, and so on. There was no looking for cost cutting, which is what they were competing on prior. And it took them a couple of years, but they were, and then the market moved beyond them with Apple coming out with way cool laptops and stuff. And it is interesting. Last week I saw an ad where they're coming back and competing with Apple on the reliability aspect of their laptops, the thin and durable. Mm-hmm. But I think the notion is that, for a new technology, is you have to be as good as or better than the existing competitive technology.
Right.
Right. But it's more the soft definition of reliability, of the trustworthiness and dependability. And you mentioned it, is the acceptance kind of part of it. Whereas in the reliability world, we don't typically get asked to talk to marketing strategists, right?
Right.
But if we could, show advertising showing the, remember the Mercedes car door ad where they had a robot opening and closing the door over and over again? And it was a play on that they do extensive research and work to make sure that their systems are durable, reliable.
Right.
Right. Right. So part of the marketing piece is, what is being put into making it safe? One, what is being put into it to make it durable and reliable? And then if it fails, that fails safe. Now, that didn't work for the nuclear industry because I think the perceived risk is so high. Whereas with a vehicle, I think there's still a huge risk there, but I think it has to be put in. And it's a dangerous thing to do, is to put it in context, to basically call the Fords and GMs death traps. Although at some point, I'm sure that's going to be part of the marketing.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty interesting. I mean, I guess the bottom line is you can start with putting out the math, right? So somebody did die in an autonomous vehicle, but what is the average miles per death? You know, something we also were talking about earlier, you know, and how does it compare to, you know, other vehicles?
Yeah. I have to see if I can track down that statistic. I think it was not quite double, but it was like 86 million miles per death in a standard car versus 130 some million miles for the one crash in the autonomous car.
Right. And with a new technology that they're working bugs out in, like, which is impressive, right? That means it's going to become substantially better than that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's kind of, you know, I think the other thing too is it would be interesting to take a true poll amongst people, how much it bothers them, because, you know, we're reading articles that people are trying to sell magazines and they're going to put very, you know, dramatic headlines in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how does the everyday person feel about it? You know, I really don't know, actually. I don't know what kind of people are like now worried about autonomous vehicles, or if they're like, yeah, it happens. You know, I don't know. I haven't gotten a sense yet.
Well, yeah, I was talking to Diane about it, my wife, and it was just that it's, you know, it's going to happen, and it's unfortunate for the person that got killed by it. But our take basically was that it's new, and she has a Subaru. She bought a new car a few months ago, and it has a cruise control feature that she really likes, and it moderates your speed depending on traffic. So it has some kind of sensing system that picks up the car in front of you, and you can set what your following distance is, where you're comfortable at, right? And then if a car in front of you slows down, your car brakes, right? And if the car in front of you speeds up to the speed limit where you set the cruise control, it will speed up to the cruise control. If somebody pulls in the gap, it backs off to get the distance again. So it's one of the features of an autonomous driving car, but it doesn't steer for her. She has to keep her hands on the wheel to keep it on the road. So I think Subaru's strategy is not to go full autonomous. It's let's add this feature. Remember the ads a couple of years ago where the high-end cars were self-parking?
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Well, this is the weird thing Tesla did though, right? They crossed that line where I kind of questioned it when they did it though, because it does seem like a potential issues, because the Subaru version, you still have to stay engaged in driving, right? So there's either you're engaged in driving or you're not engaged in driving, right? Tesla has this weird thing where they're like, oh, you don't have to do anything, but you have to pay attention. Like, of course, that's not going to happen, right? Like, there's no way that if I have nothing I have to do with it, I'm going to take advantage of the time. I'm going to close my eyes. I'm going to talk to somebody. I'm going to email. Well, so that's kind of the weird,
no texting, right? Though. No texting. That's all against the law.
Yeah, right. Exactly. But that's the weird thing, right? So once you take that very last task that the driver has to do away, you then kind of really can't request them to be any part of the process, I would say, fairly.
Yeah, and I think the bit of the news that I saw was that the car, and I don't know how it does it, if it's through the seat or some other mechanism, but it nudges the driver to stay awake, basically, to stay engaged. I agree with you. It's crossed that boundary to where you're in the Jetsons type vehicle, where it's just a pod and you tell it where to go and it goes. Where, and you know, when you mentioned you would disengage, I don't know if I'd ever let go of the wheel with an autonomous driving car, just because I've got 50 years worth of driving in cars where you had to be fully engaged. I don't even take my hands off my bicycle handlebars. But the idea of like a cruise control, if up on a freeway and traffic going smoothly, I put it on cruise control and I do take my foot off the pedal and away from the brakes.
But the bottom line is you're still engaged. You're still a part of the process.
Right.
I don't understand how you can say you no longer have to be a part of the process, but you have to pay attention. To me, you can't do that. You're either a part of the process or you're totally free of any duty. I think it's just asking for trouble to imply that, like, for them to blame this on the driver, I think if they choose to do that is ridiculous. You've told him he doesn't have to do anything.
Right, right.
You know,
yeah, it's going to be interesting how it plays out in the society, essentially, and then what ramification that has for, and what we need to do is call our friends at the reliability group, and they probably won't tell us, but is, did this just double the reliability requirements? Is that the strategy? Or is it more of a PR and marketing campaign to build confidence in society that it's okay?
Right, right.
I think the market will speak in the next quarter. They just reported they had some nice growth in the last quarter of sales of Teslas. I wonder how this will affect the next year's. I'm quite sure there weren't lines in the lobby to buy the Model S's this weekend.
Actually, that would be very interesting to see if it did have an effect, because I could imagine it also not having an effect. I really, if you asked me to predict, you said buy stock and how many are going to be sold tomorrow, I really wouldn't know which way if it would have an effect or not, because, you know, a lot of people do react like, yeah, people die in car accidents and they're dying less than these. And I don't know. Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll have to stay tuned and watch this one, but it's one that you can imagine that you're bringing out a new technology, and if it's in the news already, if like the delivery drones or autonomous driving is, well, how good does it need to be? And how do you, I mean, there's the technical challenge of actually achieving that with something that's brand new. But second is failures will happen.
I think what's interesting too is the big lesson here, I think, for engineers, reliability engineers, and product development teams is to, in advance and as you're defining the product, meet, you know, get together, discuss this, and have this hammered out in advance. Because what I actually experience as a problem with this is halfway through a program or even farther, these discussions are happening. And the decision you make on this can have a significant effect on a lot of fundamentals for the program.
Oh, certainly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not something that we typically think of. We think of the technology itself and a corrosion problem, for example, might be our dominant issue. So we focus on that without really considering the ramifications of how's that affect customer perception.
Yep.
That's a new aspect, but well worth considering as a reliability professional. What happens when it fails? What does it do to the psyche of the customer base?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, let's keep tabs on this one, Adam. I think the notion of how this develops and what Tesla's response is going to be over the long term will be interesting. At least they're not being called into congressional hearings at the moment. So I guess that might be coming.
Yeah, exactly.
So we'll see. All right. Well, let's wrap it up there. And if you happen to know more about this or feel passionate one way or the other about this new technology and how it gets accepted by society and our role as a reliability professional on that, maybe you've got experience with a different industry, having gone through this, let us know. Adam and I, and I'm certain many of our other listeners, or many of the listeners would be interested too. So head over to reliability.fm and find the episode on the Tesla, is it reliable enough type discussion, and leave us a comment or go up to iTunes and leave us a rating and review. We'd love to hear from you on this topic or on any other topic you'd like to join us. So grab your cup of coffee and come on down. With that, Adam, we'll wrap up for this one.
All right. Sounds good. Take care.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.